Comics. Comics.
Welcome to Omen Revelations Podcast, the flagship show of the Omen Comics Podcast Network. I'm Steve Sellers, and I will be your co-host for today. On ORP, my good friend Mike Nunnally and I tackle pop culture and other topics, as well as the craft of writing and more. On this episode, Mike and I are going to continue our discussion of the Predator franchise. We already discussed the original Predator and the comic Predator Concrete Jungle in Part 1. So check that out if you're interested in what we had to say about those. For this episode, we're going to turn our attention to Predator 2 and the Dark Horse comic adaptation of that film. Before we get started, Mike, do you have any thoughts you want to share before we continue?
I have a little bit to say here, yeah. I guess I would like to start by clearing up something from last episode. While I did say that I believe in many ways Concrete Jungle is superior to Predator 2, that was in no way intended to impugn the quality of Predator 2. I like Predator 2 a lot, and that should tell you how much I like Concrete Jungle and not how little I think of Predator 2. At least that was my intent. Hopefully that makes sense. Sorry if it sounded like that in the first episode. I mean, I knew what I meant, but I'm just not sure it came across that way. Anyway, enough of my rambling. Let's get started, Steve.
Sure. Since we talked about the Concrete Jungle comic last time, let's move on to Predator 2, the film that Concrete Jungle inspired. For the longest time, nobody knew for sure Predator 2 would even happen. According to screenwriters Jim Thomas and John Thomas, a Predator sequel had not been planned, and they had to wait to see how successful the Predator comic book series would be. After that series was a hit, producer Joel Silver was finally able to convince Fox to make the sequel, which was immediately greenlit. The Thomas brothers pitched six ideas for Predator 2, and Fox ultimately went with the idea of the Predator hunting in an urban jungle. It should be noted that the reason Fox took that pitch is because they believed that setting it in the city would lower production costs for the film. The original storyline of the film was that it would have taken place in New York City, presumably echoing the story in Concrete Jungle. But Jim Thomas and John Thomas quickly changed it to Los Angeles, again, because of budget concerns. The scene where this predator raises a skull during the lightning storm, which I call the quickening scene, was to have taken place across atop the Chrysler Building. But that plan was changed when they moved it to L.A. But there's one piece of the puzzle that was surprisingly missing from this film, and that is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mike, do you want to get into what happened with Arnold and why he's sir not appearing in this film?
Sir not appearing. That's awesome. Sure thing, Steve. There is more than one story about this, actually. So I will tell you what I know, and you can see which ones you think are true. According to producer John Davis, Arnold Schwarzenegger refused to be in Predator 2 because he wanted more money, an additional $250,000 to be exact, and Fox refused to pay him. However, director Stephen Hopkins said that Arnold Schwarzenegger liked the script, but that taking the role would have required postponing the production of 1990s Kindergarten Cop. Also, Schwarzenegger was given the option to either do 1990s Predator 2 or 1991's Terminator 2 after Kindergarten Cop. And James Cameron, Arnold's friend, talked him into doing T2. And even Hopkins doesn't blame Arnold for choosing, in his words, one of the greatest science fiction films ever made. Not to mention the hassles and the massive rewrites of the script that would have had to been done in order to work him into the story. Hopkins was actually relieved. And with that out of the way, what do you say we dive into Predator 2, Steve?
Sounds like a good idea to me. Though I will say that it is a shame that Arnold didn't come back, and I can't blame her prioritizing Terminator 2 either. It's like, which do you pick? Predator 2 or possibly the greatest sequel ever made? Yeah, so, I mean, that was a great decision for him, no question. Now, before we really dive in, I have to mention at this point that the Lethal Weapon connections with the early Predator films are interesting, but they go to a whole new level in this movie. I mean, Shane Black played Hawkins in the first movie, and by itself, it doesn't have any huge significance. I mean, he was the writer on Lethal Weapon. But in this movie, you get Danny Glover playing a hero cop in L.A. So you have Roger Murtaugh trying to play Martin Riggs, making him both chaos and mayhem. On top of that, Gary Busey, who played the villain in the original Lethal Weapon, is one of the main antagonists in this movie as well. I can't help but wonder if the filmmakers had Lethal Weapon on the brain when they made this movie. Like, they wanted to do Lethal Weapon meets Predator film with the serial numbers filed off. Am I alone in that, Mike, or did you have another idea?
Well, as we discussed in our Lethal Weapon episodes, Lethal Weapon is the perfect formula for how a buddy cop story should be done. Granted, Detective Schaefer and Raich are totally different duo than Riggs and Murtaugh, but consider that Shane Black's Lethal Weapon came out just 2 years before Concrete Jungle and was a very popular movie because it was so damn good. What if Verheiden was influenced by Black's spot-on formula, and what if that shows just how fluid the formula is, that it can work with totally different character personalities as well? You just basically, you need one guy slightly off the hinges and dangerous, in this case John Schaefer, and another family man trying to play things a bit more straight, like Detective Errol Raich.
That's very possible. I mean, that crossed my mind as well when I read Concrete Jungle. I'm not gonna lie, you definitely have that dynamic of these two experienced cops, the maverick tough guy and the older guy who settled down with the family. I'm too old for this. But it might be Predator 2 that they wanted to lean a little bit into the formula without duplicating it exactly. Now, while we're on the subject of cool actor mentions, I'll also throw this one out there. Firefly fans like me especially will love this one. The main henchman of Peter Keyes, the Gary Busey character, is none other than Adam Baldwin. Yes, that is Jane Cobb from Firefly and the Serenity film. I keep finding movies that I'd seen way back in the day that I never realized that Baldwin was in, including this movie in Full Metal Jacket, but this was a surprising one to me. As Jane would say, "Shiny, let's be bad guys."
You know, I love catching actors and actresses like that now in old movies back when I didn't know who they were. I think the last one that really got me was Jared Leto in Fight Club. I had no idea who he was back then and was actually surprised to see him in Fight Club years later. So while I did not watch Firefly, I can at least relate on that level, I guess.
I can understand that. There are a lot of actors you don't really notice until later in their careers. But let's get back to Predator. Although we're going to mention it a bit later, I want to bring up Tony Pope, the crime tabloid reporter that Harrigan punches in the face. Pope was played by Morton Downey Jr., who was at that time pretty famous for his big mouth. He was a talk show host for a while. That was unbelievably perfect casting. It's a casting choice that's only funny if you know who Downey is, and I doubt too many people remember him now. He's not a huge character in the film, but he's a memorable side character that worms his way out of the film because he's so punchable. Sadly, the Predator does not get him.
No, he doesn't. I don't personally know him, but assuming Morton Downey Jr. is not like Tony Pope at all in real life, I have to say that he's really good at making you hate his character, and that is talented. I mean, he wasn't really doing anything that was so bad, but we get to see his character through the eyes of the cops and the OWLF agents as well. Also, his Tony Pope is almost as punchable as Claude Rains' Prince John. But let's get into the film, see.
Claude Rains definitely holds the crown on that one. But sure thing. Though I will agree that Pope has a very punchable face. So in the scene where the Predator kills the Jamaicans, I notice a pretty clear shout out to the first film. Once the Jamaicans realize that somebody is there, they go all out and shooting in the direction of the Predator like Blaine did in the first film. Of course, they don't get him because he's invisible and they're shooting where he wants them to shoot. But it is pretty much in line with Predator 1, where they fire blindly into the wilderness with heavy weapons and similarly don't even get a scratch on the Predator. People really need to start saving their ammo.
You know, I mean, the only common thread I can think of is long-range weapons. And each instance in the original Predator, both with Hopper and his men, and when Dutch did it to Jungle Hunter, and here in Predator 2 with the Jamaican Voodoo Posse and the commuters on the subway, we see ranged weapons used. And someone or several people did not see where it came from. But I didn't notice it was actually a theme until just now. That was a good catch. And folks definitely need to start thinking about their ammo supplies. But I believe you had an issue with something about the film, didn't you, Steve?
I did, in fact. So one thing bothered me on rewatching Predator 2, and that is that Leona being pregnant comes out of nowhere in this film. In fact, there is no indication that Leona might even be married or involved with anyone. She never mentions it when Jerry tries to hit on her, which you think would be a good time to bring that up. Leona also never
indicates she was... preferable to grabbing his nuts, by the way.
Yes, it would be. Leona also never indicates she was either having a child or thinking about it. The pregnancy does provide a very cool moment, admittedly, that explains why the predator spares her life later on in the film. But it's just not set up at all. But it turns out that there is an explanation for why the story turned out like this, isn't there, Mike?
There is, actually. And we can, I think, blame the editor on this one. There was a larger subplot in the film surrounding Leona's pregnancy originally. We would have met Leona's husband, Rick, at the bar when the team was there celebrating Leona's birthday and Harrigan was going over Lambert's surveillance footage. There would not have been a mention about Leona's pregnancy at the party, though, as nobody she knew that she was pregnant at the time. However, as you pointed out, Steve, without meeting her husband at the bar or even mentioning that she is married, the pregnancy comes out of nowhere and we're left wondering who the father was. I mean, how much time could that have possibly taken that it needed to be cut? Especially when they make a big reveal about it. Planting that seed is necessary and could have even been done by just casually mentioning Rick or even that she was married at all at some point. I just don't get it, honestly.
I don't either. The idea behind a Chekhov's gun is that it needs to be planted in the right place at the right time before you fire it. If you don't do that, the reveal just looks like it's coming straight out of left field as it was here. It's the foreshadowing that sells the big moment later, but let's move on to some points that work better. So they do manage to maintain some low-key connections between Predator 2 and the original film, though they are different movies in many respects. The main point of contact is through the government, represented by Peter Keyes, who is the Gary Busey character. Like in the first film, the government acts in pretty shady ways, and I'm honestly starting to think that they're the Weyland Yutani of the Predator franchise. They want the Yautja's technology for themselves, and they're willing to use underhanded means to accomplish that goal. Fair enough. The most obvious connection is with Anna, who is Dylan's prisoner in the first film, who ends up working for Keyes in the second film. And in fact, there's a blink and you miss it moment very, very briefly. I wouldn't be surprised if Keyes had worked out a deal with Anna, like giving her asylum or even American citizenship in exchange for cooperation in catching the Predator. But that's not the only connection that Keyes has with the first movie. According to Gary Busey, when he was interviewed on the set of Predator 2, Dylan, the Carl Weathers character from the first movie, was working for Peter Keyes the whole time. It was Keyes who commissioned the CIA operation in the Central American jungle, and he used Dylan to send Dutch and his team to the jungle to draw out the Predator. Sending Dutch and the team to the jungle to eliminate the gorillas was a ploy. Dylan wasn't aware that Keyes was actually using him, Dutch and his team to catch the Predator. So let me drop a theory on you, Mike. Thinking about it now, I'm wondering if it was Keyes who trained Dylan to be an intelligence operative, or at least groomed him. It was probably Keyes who influenced Dylan to be a manipulator the way that we saw in the first film. Their methods and viewpoints are very similar when you compare them. They care about results, and they'll use anyone if it means getting the job done. I really would not be surprised if Dylan took notes from Keyes' playbook, at least, but he had more of a conscience, and he couldn't play the game nearly as well. Does that sound plausible at all?
I'm gonna say no. In 1987, Dylan was already the head of CIA operations in Cantamana, Peru, where a rebel movement was attempting to overthrow the American-backed government. I think that Keyes used his CIA connections to tap into someone already working in that area, and Dylan was already working in Peru, which is just southwest of Colombia's border. But I have no doubt that Keyes schooled him on how to handle Dutch. In fact, if you ask me, the whole expendable asset spiel was the line that Keyes used on Dylan to convince him to betray his friend. When he was saying those things, he sounded like a parrot, just repeating back what he had heard and not actually sharing those beliefs himself. How does that sound?
That certainly sounds like a plausible theory that accounts for the timeline that we know. Either way, Keyes' influence on Dylan is unmistakable, and it accounts for Dylan's change in character, even if the details aren't necessarily what I guessed. So that's fine with me. But speaking of the first film, let's turn our attention to Dutch and what happened behind the scenes with his character. In the original draft of the screenplay, Dutch from the original film was set to return, and he was going to lead a team to hunt down the Predator in L.A. To clear up some speculation, Dutch did not become a villain, nor did Arnold psych any kind of dislike for the script when he decided not to come back, so that wasn't really a factor. Also, the character of Peter Keyes was always part of the plan, but he became much bigger after it became clear that Dutch wasn't coming back. Keyes had already had a much smaller role in the original screenplay, but it was expanded after Schwarzenegger moved on to do Total Recall and T2, and Dutch was written out. Still, they did have an answer for this, even if it wasn't explained directly in the film. In a backstory explaining Dutch's absence from the sequel, Keyes had learned of Dutch's encounter with the Predator and tracked him down to a hospital. Dutch was being treated for radiation sickness, thought to be a result of the exposure to the Predator's self-destruct device. After hearing Dutch's account of events, Keyes and the OWLF team were sent to the jungle to investigate, and they studied the site where the Predator detonated the device. They found evidence of a spaceship launch in the jungle, and the deceased Predator ship had automatically returned to the Predator homeworld. Dutch later escaped from the hospital and vanished, and Keyes believed he was still alive. So he's gone, and he's presumably off the grid during the events of Predator 2, you know, probably keeping away from Keyes, though he would have made an appearance had Arnold wanted to stick around.
Nice one. You know, you brought up the OWLF, and I was curious about Peter Keyes and the organization that he was actually a part of. So I did some digging, and I found some very interesting things out of both Predator 2 and a bit from Concrete Jungle and a fair amount of James A. Moore's Predator Hunters and Hunted. Keyes is the head of a top secret CIA program known as the Otherworldly Lifeforms Program, or OWLF. Ulf's entire purpose was to gain access to Yautja technology, as you mentioned, Steve, but they also wanted their weaponry, and they desperately wanted to capture a live Yautja for study. As you said earlier, Steve, Keyes was actually the man who used Dylan to bring in Dutch's team. So he was in on it all along, and he was the first to arrive when it was over. The first time we see Peter Keyes, he is leading the OLWF team to investigate what we saw in the first Predator movie. They called it the Valverde incident. The team tracked down Alan Dutch Schaefer in a VA hospital in Tennessee being treated for radiation sickness from the blast of the Yautja's bomb. Despite his condition, the team learned what had happened in Guatemala from Dutch. They also tracked down the other survivor from that encounter, Ana Gonzalez, and she was apprehended and interrogated. After that, a research team was sent to Guatemala to investigate what Dutch had told them. There they saw the destruction of the Yautja's weapons and what the bomb did to the jungle. Dutch ended up disappearing, and they didn't find him again, and the entire Guatemalan investigation was frustratingly shut down. But Ulf has files on Yautja and their visits to Earth going at least 700 years back.
If it's 700 years, they only know a fraction of what the Yautja have been doing, given that we know they've been using Earth as a hunting ground for millennia. But that's still not too bad for a society that hasn't been aware for the Predators for that long. Even so, it's still not good enough for the Alf to overcome the City Hunter, leaving Harrigan to go after him alone. So the big chase between Harrigan and the Predator at the end of the film goes through a few phases. Early on, Harrigan chases the City Hunter through the rooftops and then into an apartment building. They run through an old lady's apartment in the middle of Jeopardy, and that leads into the chase through the tunnels under the city, and that leads to the Predator ship. Also, as an aside, I had to look this up because the question was really nagging at me when I saw it. The movie brings up a Jeopardy question about medieval royalty, and Alex Trebek asks about a woman named Berengaria and who she married in Cyprus. The movie never gives you the answer to this, so I had to find it on my own. The answer is King Richard the Lionhearted. Berengaria was his queen. You're welcome.
I absolutely love that you did that. That is awesome.
Why, thank you. But getting back to the finale, we see that Harrigan and the City Hunter get to the Predator ship. There's a lot in this sequence that isn't delivered with dialogue, and these are mainly hinted at through visual cues. Probably the most important one is the wall of trophies, where we see the various things that the Predator has collected. Mike, I know you love your Easter eggs, so do you want to talk about the things that the Yautja have mounted on their wall? Was there anything that stuck out to you?
There were three, actually. The most obvious one is the very large Xenomorph skull on the wall, which is an obvious nod to the AVP comics, which had been running for a whole year by the time Predator 2 came out. Of course, we see King Willy's skull and Lambert's as well, but I did not recognize any of the other ones. But let's get to the finale, Steve.
I think there was a dinosaur skull in there as well. But the Xenomorph is the one that everyone tends to remember. And at the time, I know I wanted to see an Alien versus Predator film. Seeing the Xenomorph skull build a lot of anticipation, maybe too much for the actual films to live up to. But I think we're drifting a little bit off topic for that one. So let's get back to the main story. So Harrigan ends up defeating the City Hunter, and then other Predators start to decloak. And first you're one left wondering if Harrigan is going to die here because he can't take an entire group of Predators at once, no matter how tough he is. But then the leader, who I presume is some kind of clan elder, just gives Harrigan an antique flintlock pistol and just lets Harrigan go. It's never explained why the Yautja do this, but since you're more familiar with the comics, Mike, I'd hope that you might have a little bit of insight. Would I be right in guessing that the Predators considered Harrigan a worthy opponent and that they felt that he earned honor in killing the City Hunter? Or am I misreading the situation and there's something else behind it that I'm not aware of?
Well, I will answer that, but first I just got to say, how badass was that when Harrigan dropped that disc and he's just like, all right, who's next? I mean, beat to shit, barely standing up. He's like, fine, let's just do this. That was pretty badass. But you are correct there. And I will add that honoring a non-Yautja with a gift for defeating one of their clan or tribe members is part of the code as a sign of respect, which the victor is now owed in their eyes. So yes, it's earned, but it's also the victor's right. Did you notice how the elder turned to walk away and then he was like, oh yeah, you know, I owe Harrigan a gift. And that's when he gave it to him. I hope that answers your question. But now I have one for you. We're about to dive into the Predator 2 comic. Did you have anything you wanted to say before we dive into it?
Sure, but to address your earlier point, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It sounds like a keep what you kill ethos, kind of like the Necromongers in the Riddick series. Anyway, this movie does hold up pretty well as it is. I mean, it's got some flaws, but nothing I'd consider fatal or too glaring. The absence of Arnold Schwarzenegger is noticeable, but I think Danny Glover as Harrigan is good enough to make up for that. But I think Predator 2 is better with a more complete understanding of what the writers were going for, and the comic version to fill in some important gaps. Mike, why don't you tell us about the comic and who was involved with it?
I'd love to. Predator 2 was written by Franz Henkel, based on the original screenplay by brothers Jim and John Thomas. They are the same writers that wrote the 1987 Predator movie. Henkel's comics version of Predator 2 is only a two-issue comic book adaptation of the film, and I think it needed at least three and maybe even four to do it justice. One of the reasons that Concrete Jungle was a great comic was because it got four issues to develop, and even that had a rushed ending. Did you get that feeling reading Predator 2 as well, or was it just me?
I did somewhat. This book definitely needed more issues to pace the story out better. You can definitely tell they cut some corners to manage their page count. But even with all that, the comic presents a fairly faithful adaptation of the film, with minor additions and deletions compared to the movie on which it's based. Several of the alterations are shared with the film's novelization. Mike, would you like to talk about some of the specific changes and what you thought of them?
Sure. Well, I like the news reporters in the film. I think they work as a great, I honestly think they work as a great narrative. It would seem that they basically cut almost all of that out in the comics. Tony Pope, who is a regular pain in the ass in the movie, only shows up one time in the comics.
It is true that Tony Pope doesn't appear nearly as much, and the Predator doesn't get him here either. But then the film tends to focus a lot more on the news broadcasts, which is where Pope tends to be featured more. And some of it is the presence of Morton Downey Jr. and maybe wanting to give him more room with that character. Sometimes films evolve just because of the presence of certain actors and wanting to give them more depth to those roles. I mean, it seems like that may have been the case with Downey.
I think it's because of the one scene in the comics that Pope appears and Captain Pilgrim punches him in his very punchable face. I gotta assume that's why they went with that. But Pope does get abused a few times in the film. I noticed something else too. The gangs were handled a lot differently in the comics. Even the names are different. The Colombian Scorpions gang that is fighting the Jamaicans and the Yautja is called the El Scorpios in the comic. In the movie, just one cocaine-snorting guy calling himself El Scorpio. also, in the comics, Detective Leona Cantrell shoots the El Scorpio guy several times in the chest as he's fleeing the massacre of his fellow gang members, but he's wearing body armor. But in both cases, he runs up the stairs to the roof.
I noticed that the movie ratchets the Scorpion gang up to 11, speaking of that. The opening with the gang shootout is noticeably different from the film to the comic. In the comic, there isn't the whole Warzone TV coverage and some of the over-the-top behavior in the shootout from early on in the movie. The Scorpions come across as homicidally insane and just enjoying causing chaos and mass carnage. The comic does have the shootout as well, but it seems framed more as a moment for Harrigan to establish himself as a badass, which it does, reminiscent of Concrete Jungle.
Very much, very much. I would like to point out something that just occurred to me. The car from Concrete Jungle was mm-hmm. much like that homicidally insane perception of the Scorpions. He was all about, he didn't even want to make a deal with Lamb. He didn't care about profits or anything. He just wanted to kill people and cause chaos. So, I mean, in that respect, maybe they got it from that. I don't know. But there was definitely no doubt of that from the start. I knew it when he busted the door off of the car. Harrigan was definitely a badass. And the scene where Harrigan argues with Deputy Chief Hanneman outside of the armory after the shootout and subsequently watches Keyes and his men arrive is absent in the comic altogether. They gloss over a lot of those details. Instead, a two-panel flashback shows some history between Harrigan and Hanneman, explaining that the latter has burned political bridges in order to get Harrigan to where he is today, and Harrigan is making Hanneman look bad because of it. Not to mention all of those bridges that Hanneman had burned were now turning up the heat on his ass too. Really, they are two friends on opposite sides of things here.
You know, this is one thing that Predator 2 does better than Concrete Jungle, in my view. The comic focuses on the buddy-cop dynamic, but you don't really get a deep look at the dynamics in the department. I feel like the movie and the comic gives us a good explanation for why the department puts up with Harrigan, which is something that Schaefer could have used, especially after he tried to choke his boss. The comic does dive a bit deeper into those things than the film does as well, and it was nice to see that. But speaking of the relationship between the cops and the precinct, Mike, I think you had something to add about the other detectives.
I do, actually. This specifically colors Detective Lambert in a considerably worse light. So there's this funny scene where Detective Leona Cantrell grabs Jerry Lambert's family jewels when he tries to put the moves on her. In the movie, she says that Lambert's last partner got shot, but in the comic, she says it's his last three partners that got shot because of his Lone Ranger bullshit. That really amps up the liability issue with Lambert quite a bit.
Yeah, I didn't notice it at first, but thinking about it, I think you're right. I mean, one dead partner can be written off as an accident, but three suggests a pattern. It's probably for the best that they change that number, especially since it doesn't really become a problem for the cops in this film. But, you know, Mike, this is a case where the actors really make a difference, because Bill Paxton's performance as Jerry Lambert really brought that character to life in a way that we just don't see in the comics. Paxton took this character who comes off as a jerk, and he makes him a likable character even in that moment. The comic version doesn't have Paxton's charm, charisma, and personality, and it's definitely missing in the book. Now, there's a moment in the film that I may need your input on, Mike. So the Jamaican gang tends to be heavily built around the voodoo theme. I really had my doubts about whether their portrayal in this film was even remotely accurate. And there's one scene in particular that goes into voodoo rituals, and I think you know which one I'm thinking of. There are some differences between the film and the comic on this one, too, but since you're more into mythology and folklore than I am, Mike, I'd like to hear your take on it.
I'd be happy to give it to you then. In the movie, all we know is that the Jamaican voodoo posse was killing a Colombian drug lord of some type in the voodoo ritual to take his soul. I won't get into all of it here, as this is just a side point anyway, but it is highly unlikely that the Jamaicans would be using voodoo, or more accurately, hoodoo, as we see in the film. The root religion, which I believe is Obeah, developed very differently in Jamaica and does not resemble voodoo or hoodoo at all. Hoodoo is an American practice created by enslaved Africans in the southern United States from various traditional African spiritualities, Christianity, and elements of indigenous botanical knowledge. But that said, there are two other differences between the comics and the film. In the comics, it says that the Colombians being sacrificed is Ramon Vega, the crack king of East LA, at least in the comic. Also, in the comic, the Jamaican voodoo posse never removed Ramon Vega's heart, and in the movie, they do.
Firstly, I have to say that Jamaican voodoo posse sounds like a great band name. I have to use it somewhere. But now you're getting into what bothered me about the scene. I had a hard time believing that what they were showing was actual hoodoo. And I doubt the writers, either on the film or the comic, actually consulted any experts on real-world hoodoo. But I didn't know enough to really say anything definitive either way, so thanks for clearing that up. That said, it's possible that the Jamaican gang members aren't real hoodoo practitioners either, and they don't take the real religion seriously. It might be that they're just using the voodoo gimmick as a way of making people afraid of them. If that's what they were doing, they did a good job with it, especially when they go full Mola Ram on that dude.
So you guys are trying to scare me, right? Well, it worked. I'm scared now. First of all, Jamaican Voodoo Posse does sound like a great band name. Maybe some reggae hip-hop kind of a thing. But as for the people supposedly doing hoodoo in that scene, I actually did get the impression that the guy performing the ritual was just going through the motions because he had no respect for what he was doing and even mocked his belief with the fucking voodoo magic, man. And his friends just laughed along with him. King Willie may be a believer, but I think these guys are just thugs. However, shortly after that scene, something else goes down differently in the comics. Just after getting discovered by the OWLF in Ramon Vega's apartment, Keys goes to warn Harrigan about making him disappear the next time he gets in their way. But it is more privately done on Ramon Vega's balcony in the comics. Also in the comics, there is a guy I assume works for the LAPD forensics department, and he's barking orders about where to put forensics equipment, and he's wearing a badge on his hip.
I think the context does change the scene somewhat. On the balcony, Keys is in a more secure position, and we see that with the photojournalist that gets dragged away by Keys' goons. There's more of a sense of menace with Keys threatening Harrigan there. Doing it at the station makes it seem more innocuous, with the threat being more veiled. On the other hand, the film has Gary Busey, who is very good at sounding dangerous and menacing, so I guess it just depends on what works best for your interpretation of the story.
Technically, Keys threatened Harrigan twice, once in Vega's apartment and once at the station, though I definitely agree about the balcony. But let's get back to that evening. While the investigation goes on without them upstairs, downstairs from Ramon Vega's apartment, Leona Cantrell lets Mike and Danny know that the feds, actually OLWF, confiscated the bodies at the tenement building and at Vega's apartment, except one body was missing, with no record or trace of it. So Harrigan asked Leona to contact his friend Nathan Caldwell with the FBI in Washington to find out everything he can about Keys as a personal request from him. But in the movie, Harrigan asked Detective Lambert to follow Keys everywhere he goes and try to find out everything he can on him at Leona's birthday party at the bar. But the party at the bar is cut out of the comics, and the conversation between Harrigan and Lambert is simply narrated.
This is, again, a scene I regret got cut because, as we discussed, the party at the bar is where Leona's husband is established, causing the Chekhov's gun problem that we talked about earlier in the film. As for trailing Keys, I think the movie made the better decision by having Lambert trail him. It gives Jerry something to do, and it allows him to prove himself to Harrigan, which tells how tightly knit a group that they all become towards the end. I mean, Jerry might act like a cocky jerk at times, but he seems to really take his job seriously, and he does want the approval of his new boss. So I think it's a move that makes sense, but why don't we get into what happens to Danny?
I can do that. What happens at Vega's apartment between Danny and the Ayuta is pretty close in both the comic and the film, but one big thing happens differently afterwards. Not only is Danny's skull and spine ripped out of him like a fish getting deboned, standing high up on a building in the lightning, the Ayuta holds up Danny's skull and spine into the sky with his combi stick in a great, glorious pose of victory. It's a similar pose to how I would picture a warrior having defeated a much greater foe with the last bit of his strength. This also happens in the film, but much later, and the Ayuta is holding the skull and spine of Jerry Lambert instead. But I'm not sure why the Ayuta was so proud of Danny's death in the comics or Lambert's death in the film. Do you have any ideas on that one, Steve?
Yeah, I'm not so sure on this one either. I mean, they were aiming for a cool moment with the quickening scene, which I think was the main goal. There could be only one! They also were trying to make it a personal battle for Harrigan. But I can throw some ideas out there and see if they make sense. It could be that the City Hunter rated Danny and Jerry as warriors in some way. I don't think that the Yarucha see police in the same way that we do. Through the lens of their culture, I mean, they may very well see just cops as trained warriors with guns, and thus they're acceptable targets. I mean, they are armed. Perhaps the Yautjas even see police as rival hunters, since they do hunt criminals. Looking at it that way, the City Hunter may even see killing Danny and Jerry as being worthy of more honor because they were trained and skilled warriors. If that sounds off base, you can let me know, but that's the best I got right now.
My guess is that the Yautja see cops as enforcers, if they see them as anything. That's the only thing in their culture like cops. I could see a rival hunter thing, though. I mean, that might fit. I don't think you're too far off there. I think seeing them as warriors is about as good as we're going to get, in fact. I think Lambert probably showed that more than Danny, however. I'm not really sure what was so special about Danny's skull, honestly. So let's move on. In the comics, after City Hunter killed Danny, they go directly to Danny's funeral, but this is cut out and replaced with Harrigan putting Danny's badge on his grave and walking away. But here's how it went down in the comics. Harrigan, Leona, Jerry, and Captain Pilgrim attend Danny's funeral, and when it's over, Tony Pope makes his only appearance in the comic to harass Harrigan for the story. What's awesome is that Captain Pilgrim punches Tony Pope right in the mouth and reminds him they're at a funeral. But something is different now with the captain. He no longer opposes Harrigan's pursuit of the mysterious killer that murdered Danny. He can't say it officially, but at that moment, Pilgrim stepped out of the way.
The enforcer angle is possible, though it's hard to say for sure, so I'm willing to go with that. And no, I don't see the appeal of Danny's skull either. Anyway, it was good that Pope getting punched in the face was in the comic, too. It is such a punchable face. I agree that was an awesome moment, and Pope was asking to be smacked the entire film. Although they changed the context by having the scene take place at Danny's funeral, and honestly, nobody could blame anyone for hitting Tony Pope at that moment. So it was a change that worked. I also like that the captain gets more development and the way that the internal dynamics of the cops are handled a bit better in the book.
I like that too. The captain felt Harrigan's pain and understood. The last thing that has really changed in the first issue is the death of King Willie. In the movie, King Willie has a sword with a white rattlesnake hilt on it. It looks kind of cool. But in the comics, the dude walks around with a submachine gun. And he tries to use it to stop the Yautja. But in neither version does King Willie survive that scenario. Another difference is the Yautja speaking. King Willie tells Detective Harrigan that it was time to go. Prepare yourself. Well, in the comics, the Yautja repeats this to King Willie before he kills him. I don't know that has a little tinge on it. I think it's really revealed later on in the issue 2 that King Willie was not beheaded in the comics. But speaking of issue 2, my man Steve here is going to cover that one.
Sounds cool to me. But before I do, this last change is a relatively minor one, though I will admit to liking King Willie's sword as well. There's not much question that King Willie was set up to be killed by the City Hunter in both versions, which makes sense as he'd be a high-value target to the Predator. But let's get to the second issue, which starts in the subway. The comic makes it clear that the Predator actively follows Leona and Jerry onto the subway, seeking to kill them. The film is more ambiguous as to whether the Predator finds them by chance or design, although the novel also makes it clear that the attack is targeted. But what do you think happened, Mike?
I honestly don't see how it was a coincidence that the City Hunter came upon Lambert and Cantrell. I think they were targeted for the same reason that Danny Boy was targeted. They were connected to Mike Harrigan. You'll notice that Jungle Hunter killed off each member of Dutch's crew before finally fighting him. I think we're seeing the same tactics here.
I'm inclined to agree. I don't think that the Predator does very much by chance, especially in a huge city like L.A., especially when the M.O. of the Yautja is to slowly kill off support members until you get to the leader. It's very probable that the City Hunter really wanted Harrigan's head, seeing his value as a warrior and hoping to earn some honor by killing him. So let's get into the aftermath. When Harrigan arrives outside the subway, he finds Heinemann being savaged by furious news reporters who want to know why the LAPD has failed to find the killer and why Keyes' team, who the police had bowed down to, has now vanished. Heinemann begs Harrigan to help him deal with the situation, but he refuses, leaving Heinemann to burn. The scene was filmed for the movie, but it wasn't used.
You know, Now that I think about it, that certainly fits what can be heard in the background as Harrigan jumps onto the cars when he spots the city hunter. It really seems like he left that scenario, and you can hear it in the background there. I can easily see that scene from the comics playing out, just before Mike jumps up onto the car. I'm guessing that was the part they edited out there.
Yeah, I can as well, and you're probably right about that. It's not an essential scene, and it probably was cut for pacing in the film. But it does fill in some gaps for those of us who want a more complete understanding of what's going on in the film. But let's get into the next adaptation change, which concerns Peter Keyes. When describing the self-destructive device to Harrigan, Keyes claims the explosion in Guatemala leveled 200 acres of rainforest, not 360 blocks as in the film. Keyes also claims different motivations for his pursuit of the Predator. His team is simply trying to ensure that the bomb does not go off in the city and hopes to capture the creature and disarm the device before it can devastate Los Angeles. To be honest, I would not be surprised if that's either a rationalization or a legal justification that Keyes is using. I think it's more likely his real reason is exactly what Keyes said it was in the movie, to acquire Predator technology for the U.S. government. He might genuinely not want an explosion in the city. I mean, it's backed out of things politically, so he'd try to avoid that. He also wouldn't want any tech destroyed. At the same time, I don't think he'd lose sleep if triggering an explosion meant getting a hold of a working Predator ship with cloaking tech and advanced weapons.
That is actually one more thing that is from Concrete Jungle. Granted, it was General Phillips and New York in Concrete Jungle and Predator 2. It was Keyes in L.A., but both were worried about the effect of the Iocha self-destruct device on the city. I believe that is where the 300 city blocks worth of damage came from in the film.
It could very well be, but I don't think it matters too much in what the exact number is. I mean, if a Predator self-destruct device goes off, a large chunk of the city gets annihilated along with the Predator. But with that, let's get into the big scene in the slaughterhouse. The initial fight between Harrigan and the Predator in the slaughterhouse is far shorter in the comic, with Harrigan gunning the creature down as soon as he blasted Wade inside. Keyes is beheaded by the smart disc and not bisected as in the film. Again, nothing hugely impactful in the story either way, but it does show the fight plays out differently in each version.
You know, I really enjoyed the fight in the slaughterhouse in the film, and it felt like it was way too short on the comic. I mean, they have a great opportunity for some action sequences, and they just boil all the hair off of it. But again, I think this is because they made it two issues and not three or four. But one thing I really liked from the comics and the scene in the slaughterhouse specifically was the noir-like internal monologue of Mike Harrigan. When Keyes refused to take Harrigan's warnings about the Yautja seeing them because he thought he knew better than Harrigan, he had some interesting things to say, and a bit of his hatred for any authority but his own came out. He says Keyes' attitude was typical of most of the guys who attain positions of power. They forget what it's like to be afraid. They lower their guard and lose their edge to overconfidence. Keyes and his men were paying for their complacency. But when it came to the Yautja, Harrigan likened them by saying that the Yautja was way too cool. Like Keyes, his edge was dulled from being on the winning side of things too long. This was my turn, and he was going to learn the main rule of the streets. If anything can go wrong, it will.
Agreed. First-person narration is something comics will always do better than film. Voiceovers in film tend to come across as clunky technique most of the time, and many filmmakers will try to avoid using it. But with comics, you can use narrative captions to get into the main character's head in a way that's hard to do on film. Much of the Predator 2 book focuses on Harrigan's internal monologue, and that really works for scenes like this. After the fight, there is no apartment chase with the old lady watching Jeopardy. I mean, that was purely an invention of the film. In fact, the chase doesn't even lead there at all. When Harrigan cuts off the Predator's arm, the creature does not fall into the adjacent apartment building, but instead straight down into the alleyway. Harrigan likewise climbs all the way down to the ground before following the Predator inside, down an elevator shaft, and through the sewers.
I have to say that I really like the movie version over the comics in this case. Falling into that bathroom and fixing himself up a bit made Harrigan's victory over the Yautja all the sweeter. Plus, that old lady was just the right amount of humor without losing any tempo.
I just can't imagine the story now without the Jeopardy question. but I agree. I think having an innocent civilian being caught up in the chase provides an interesting wrinkle with the fight, both for Harrigan and for the Predator. Neither of them is going to kill an unarmed old lady, even though it's for very different reasons. The Predator won't do it because it wouldn't be an honorable kill, and Harrigan won't do it because he has a duty to protect her. So I think the apartment scene spices up the scene, and the humor is balanced just right, and it breaks some of the tension in just the right way. This leads us into the comics' take on the final fight aboard the Predator ship. During the fight on the Aucha mothership in the comics, the Predator taunting Harrigan with his last words to Danny, "Watch your ass, Danny boy." But in the movie, the final fight on the ship had no dialogue at all, and it was largely a silent scene. Did that make any real difference to you, Mike? And which one worked better for you?
It made some difference. City Hunter taunting Harrigan with the last words he spoke to his best friend he'd spent 15 years on the force with shows a level of cruelty you don't really see in most Yautja. I've thought about this a little bit here, and I think that the City Hunter did not just want to beat him. He wanted to break him, to hurt him emotionally. That made the entire hunt very personal. And you know what? That paints the whole thing with City Hunter being so happy about Danny's skull in a different light. He knew how much that would emotionally hurt Harrigan. This was no regular hunt. For the City Hunter, this seems to be personal if you take the comics perspective. What do you think about that?
He might, but I'm not sure why the Predator would do that unless it's a tactical decision to throw Harrigan off. Otherwise, I'm not sure why it would benefit him. I mean, if it was a tactical decision, I think it was miscalculated because it just pisses Harrigan off. But there you go. Let's briefly get into the end of the film. I didn't want to dig too much into the antique pistol that Harrigan receives from the Aucha Elder when talking about the film because there are two very different origins for it. Even the name and date on it is different depending on which version you go by. In the comic, the flintlock pistol is marked Vito della Mirandella, Anno Domini 1640. The date 1640 is also used in the novelization. But in the film, the gun is inscribed Raphael Adelini 1715. So there's a huge amount of difference between there. Now, we do eventually find out where the Adelini pistol came from because it shows up again in 2022's Prey. Raphael Adelini actually meets Naru, the protagonist of that film, offering his engraved pistol in exchange for medicine. After a series of events that aren't worth going into here because it's outside the scope of our discussion, Naru still has the flintlock by the end of the movie. We don't know how the Predators got the pistol, whether they killed Naru later and claimed it as a trophy, or if Naru gave it to someone else and they were killed by the Yautja. I'm inclined to think they got it from Naru because the Elder Predators seem to prize it highly as a trophy. But that's all speculation on my part, and there's no evidence for it. But that's what happened in the films, and the Dark Horse comics may have played out differently. So I'll throw the question to you, Mike. Do you know anything about the Mirandella pistol, or if the Adelini pistol was used differently in any other Predator comics?
The answer to your question is, welcome to tomorrow. Sorry, I had a chance to drop a little Megadeth on you, and I had to do it. But seriously, the only thing I know about it is that it is the Raphael Adelini 1715 engraving that is canon. As I mentioned before, the movies are the franchise Bible. And for me, and to my knowledge, that is the basis for the actual canon as well. I think the real telling factor was that the pistol showed up in Prey, which I really wish we had time to cover in this episode. But I believe you had something that kind of bugged you about the movie, didn't you, Steve?
Well, it was worth a try, but yes, I do. In the film, we never really see how the Predator ship leaves its landing spot beneath the city. In the comic, it's shown clearly at the end of the second issue. When the mothership departs, it flies out of one of LA's iconic storm drains. I have to be honest, where the ship was hiding was one of the nagging questions of the film, but it seems like the comic had an answer for it.
I have to say that I thought the hiding place for the ship was just okay and didn't really fit logistically. I'm not an LA expert by any means, but I do not recall seeing one that could house a ship of the size of the one that came out of that storm drain. I'm not saying that I know where they could have hit it, but I don't see why it could have not simply dropped City Hunter down in a drop pod, other than they needed the ship to be where Harrigan and the City Hunter could get to it at the end. But I'd like to switch over to another part of the film, if we could. Heinemann says that he put his ass on the line to get Lieutenant Harrigan in Alvarado Precinct, then refers to Harrigan's job there as a cage. Mike Harrigan has served in the LAPD for 18 years and has always been combative with his superiors. Harrigan always thought that they just got in the way and didn't understand the realities cops are facing on the streets. So that definitely could be the reason he was placed in the war zone of Alvarado. Another reason could be that during his 18 years on the force, Mike Harrigan is known for using excessive force and for having an obsessive compulsive disorder. On top of that, Harrigan has destroyed 11 police cars, a bus, and even a street sweeper. So why send him to Alvarado instead of just firing him? The answer is that Harrigan also received 10 commendations of valor in the line of duty and held the best felony arrest record in the history of the LAPD. But his dedication to his duty as an officer cost him a marriage and several long-term relationships. With that little bit of history, we can see why Harrigan gave the speech to the Lone Ranger, Detective Jerry Lambert. It also explains why Lambert saying he busted his ass to get transferred to the Alvarado precincts bothers Harrigan. For Harrigan, he was being punished by being there, and Lambert fought to get there. Harrigan was worried that Lambert didn't really understand what he was getting into. Also, based on Detective Leona Cantrell being pissed that Lambert's last partner got shot and Harrigan comments about how they are a team in Alvarado precinct, maybe he would end up being a liability.
That is interesting. You know, I get the distinct sense that Harrigan doesn't want anyone else ending up in the same place that he is. He got there because he's the kind of cop that can fight that kind of street war and nobody else will take him. By that point, Harrigan knows what it takes to survive, and he wants people who have that same ability and commitment to the team. His concern with Jerry was that he was there to showboat, that he would put himself before the team, and that it would very probably get him killed. And while Jerry does get killed, honestly, I don't think it's because he was being the Lone Ranger. He was up against a really tough opponent that he didn't understand and had no real way of fighting. And in the end, I think he died the cop that Harrigan wanted him to be. Not that it gives Kerrigan much comfort.
I can totally agree with that. When you consider the Lambert's last three partners before Leona got shot in the comics, and Lambert died in the movie saving his partner and the rest of the people on the train, and that is a really nice story arc. But if I could talk about the clan of Yautja that came to Los Angeles in 1997 and hid their ship beneath the city, they are known as the Lost Tribe. There is a story outside of continuity here that this name actually comes from the crew on the movie literally losing the Yautja costumes in the final scene where we see all the other Yautja. But in story, as they had an elder with them and the city hunter was motivated by the recordings of Jungle Hunter's helmet from the first movie, I think it certainly was a tribe of Yautja, but not just any tribe. I think this tribe is kin to Jungle Hunter, and they are led by an elder named Greyback. The recordings made by the Yautja helmet go back to Yautja Prime, to the kin of the fallen Yautja. Out of the tribe, City Hunter alone was chosen to hunt, and the other higher-ranking Yautja were merely overseers of the City Hunter's hunt. When Harrigan defeated City Hunter honorably, Greyback gives him the flintlock pistol as a sign of respect, which is exactly according to Yautja Code of Honor, as I mentioned. And speaking of that Code of Honor, I would like to note that the Colombian Scorpions and the Jamaican Voodoo Posse were killing people in battles that did no harm, were not able to defend themselves, and did not have a fighting chance of victory. Not to mention, there was no concern for the consequences of those deaths by the drug lords. This violates several laws among the Yautja Code of Honor. I think that City Hunter started taking out the gangs like they were bad bloods. In other words, he was honor-bound to kill them. But the prey that City Hunter chose was Lieutenant Mike Harrigan, as seen by the Yautja watching him in the beginning. But we must assume that he investigated further, at least according to the code.
That does add quite a lot of useful context behind the City Hunter and what he was doing. The Predators do tend to target enemies that are dishonorable first, stalking their most important prey as the most honorable kill. So it would explain why the City Hunter starts by targeting the gang members, perhaps hoping it'll lure out Harrigan, the high-value target. That actually is a fairly well thought out plan, and it shows how intelligent the Yautja truly are in their methods. So now that we've discussed all the points where the film is different from the comic, I thought I'd like to run past you, Mike. The writers of the comic clearly had a copy of the script that the film was based on, because they get the gist of the story down right. You even get exact shots here and there, like the one where this predator stands on the building in the rain, where he looks like he's doing the quickening from Highlander. So they clearly had enough information about the story to get certain things accurate to the film. At the same time, we also see very notable changes as well. I'm wondering if it's possible that the creators on the comic might have been working from an earlier draft of the script and not the final version of it. This is not unheard of with some comic adaptations where the writer gets the script and then the script changes by the time they get to the final film. Do you think that might have happened with Predator 2 as well? Or might there be another reason why the comic is so different to the finished film?
I think it is highly plausible that they were working from an earlier draft. I mean, Predator 2 came out the next year after the films, and the comic could take months when you factor in the writing, the editing, the pencils, the inks, the colors, the lettering. Oh, yeah, and more editing. Then getting comics printed and or shipped out, I'm thinking that the creative team started on it way before it was even before they even finished the movie. And that would definitely mean that an earlier draft of the script was being used.
Cool, so we're on the same page on that one. That's a good note to end things on. Anyway, this concludes our latest deep dive into the early Predator films and their related comics. I have to say, while the original Predator is a classic and one of my favorite Arnold films, it had been ages since I'd seen the second one. While I don't think Predator 2 holds up quite as well as the original, it still holds up pretty well, and it's at least fun to watch. It also helps to know a lot of the behind the scenes on this one, because it helps to explain a lot of the missing pieces. Even so, I'd say that both films are worth watching and you should check them out. The comics are well worth a read, too. Mike, what's your takeaway on the Predator stories that we've talked about?
I have to say that I enjoyed the comics a lot more since I started reading the early years omnibus and researching Yautja culture. I have a whole new appreciation for both Predator and Predator 2. I'm planning on watching the other Predator movies after this, and I think I'm going to like those more as well, too. But really, I love these episodes when we get to dive into both comics, cinema, and television. I'm having a blast doing this with you, my friend.
Likewise, I always end up getting something new out of these stories when we talk about them together, and I hope our viewers do as well. So with that, we bring our Predator episode of ORP to a close. Thank you for listening, and we invite you to please check out all our other shows on the Omen Comics Podcast Network. Until next time, thanks for hanging with us, and thanks to all our patrons for making this podcast possible.
I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.